Okay, so I wanted to say something first off, just a bow of gratitude to all of you that I didn't get to see during my receiving of the Rakusu, and just a little thanks to Michael for being so brave to actually let me talk, which I think is pretty brave. So, thank you all for that. And I was just sitting here doing what I like to call Shinkantaza Light, as I was thinking about something. And I was thinking about just how wonderful it is that we have this space and this place to be able to come here and do this practice together. Because of my life, and I don't know about some of your lives, but mine has a lot of distractions in it. So there's a challenge sometimes to be able to sit quietly for an extended period of time without having interruption from a canine friend or something like that. So I'm just very grateful that I have this space here to do this. In knowing that I'm not going to be interrupted, it allows me to go a little bit more into the practice. And to have all of you here too, it just creates this incredible foundation to just sit and be held by the group. So that brings me to my topic. And I thought I'd pick something light that kind of covers desire, success, failure, just light things like that. Because I notice in my sitting practice that I have desires. And some of these desires are pretty interesting to watch. And one of them might be I might have a desire to flick a mosquito off of my forehead as it's taking a bite. And to just notice that, to just sit there and not fulfill that desire, so to speak. And it kind of brings me to the point of looking back in my life to see where maybe this desire thing first manifested. So we have to go back in time a little bit. So we should have that Scooby-Doo music that goes, ooh, so we're back in time. First the earth cooled and then the dinosaurs came. Okay, not that far. I can remember when I was young that I had a lot of desires. I wanted a lot of things. I wanted a lot of toys and books. But not only that, I wanted to do things, activities. I like to draw. I like to read books. And I like to ride my bike and I like to play with my friends. So, for the most part, up until a certain age, most of these simple desires were fulfilled. I was able to do those things with a lot of freedom and support. And then along came something called school. And when school happened, I noticed that the natural desires that I had to want to do these things had to kind of be put on hold. And I had to sit still and do something that I didn't want to do. I didn't want to be there. So a new desire arose in me, and that desire was the desire of not wanting to be where I am right now, not wanting to do what's in front of me right now. And that kind of brings me to this point of in this practice, the desire to have something, to have a person, be with a person, have a particular thing in your life, or not have something creates suffering. So, in this and noticing this great desire to have what makes me happy and not have what makes me sad. So that has pretty much been the bane of my life for many years. Pretty much wanting something that I don't have, wanting to be somewhere that I'm not, wanting to have things that I don't have, etc. And suffering because I don't have these things, or the circumstances, the situations is not the way that I want it, and I want it to change. And I think that it's unique in this practice to be able to sit here with these desires, whether they be the simple desire to want to move, And for some reason, when we come here, we suspend some of these things. Like we try to sit still. And that's pretty hard sometimes for me. My mind wants to get up, wants to go outside. It thinks Zazen and Zen is silly. Why do we sit here? Does anybody know why? Anyway, that practice allowing us this opportunity to study the self with the self, to watch what it does, to watch how things arise and thoughts arise and impulses arise. And neuroscientists say that desire might not be connected to thought as much as it's connected to something in a bodily way, where we may have a desire to eat, so our stomach is signaling us with that desire. But I tend to look at the whole thing and the whole package as thought. And this, you know, as a beginner, may be the bane of my failure. I think that everything seems to be arising from mind. That's the way I'm going to take it. Even if it's a thought to be hungry or thirsty or whatever, there are bodily impulses that will signal the brain, but in the end it becomes a thought. So in sitting here, in this kind of radical acceptance of what is so, what is happening, and sitting with those desires to want to move, to want the mind to stop, I'm sure that some people desire that their mind stops while they sit here in meditation, gives us the opportunity to really look at mind and how it operates, and how simply by sitting, with really not doing anything but just sitting, we can see that something is sitting. Even though there might be this desire to get up, to leave the room, to swat at the mosquito, to move. Something sits. And I find this something to be what brings me back to this practice. And the brief history of the practice for me was about 2.5 years ago, while I was working at Yahoo, my wife saw that I was having a tough time at work and thought I could use a retreat. So she looked online and found this place. And she thought, well, Robert will go and he'll have a nice retreat, a relaxing retreat, and then he can go back to work refreshed and invigorated. And I thought to myself, well, that would be wonderful. I came here and I met Angie, and they were just starting a session, and I told her, well, I felt that there was a pretty solid practice with this group, and I thought that maybe I might be infringing upon that. So I said to her, what do you do? And she said, well, what do you do? And I said, I sit quietly. And she said, oh, well, that's what we do. So you come and sit quietly with us. And I'm like, oh, this sounds great. So I joined the session. And about the third day in, I found out a lot of things about desire. Yeah, I desired to leave. I desired to move. I wanted to end the suffering that the practice in itself was creating. And in that moment, I had just a brief inkling of the Heart Sutra, and we just had the study session on the Heart Sutra. So that brief moment of hearing the Heart Sutra in nobody, you know, the whole thing of nothing, I was kind of relieved for a brief moment of that desire to want to get up and go when I heard those words. And in that kind of got me attracted to keep returning, because there was this brief interlude between all the terrible suffering that I was experiencing and absolute quiet and nothing and a respite from that. So, supposedly, in this practice, what we do is look at this desire, this flow of it, and analyze it, see where it comes from. And there's a concept of having a desire to practice may not be associated with a desire that would cause suffering. And I find this to be kind of an interesting correlation. because for me there is a desire to do this practice. I want to do it, so that's a desire. So I come here and I sit and I do this practice. So I was looking that up a little bit today and read about what the Buddha had to say about this and the processes to create an adapted desire that's a skillful desire. And in this sitting, there's a desire to do this, but it's a skillful desire. So when we sit here like this, we're taking away all these distractions in our life. We're taking away I'm very distracted at work and in my life. I have a lot of devices. I have computers and phones and multitasking. I have to do 10 things at once. And I have a lot of pressure around that. So there's a tremendous desire not to be at work now that kind of correlates between the desire of not wanting to be at school. And I find that very interesting in my observation, that there still is that desire, even after many years of practice. Before this practice, I was involved in another type of meditation practice. But to still have that arise, to still have that grass is greener thing happening constantly, coming from the mind, seeking pleasure, avoiding pain, wanting to have things fill a void inside that will somehow create a moment of happiness, a brief moment of the respite of the struggle, of the suffering. The wanting and the need, the desire, the hook into that with your mind, and then the release when you finally have the thing you want. It could be simple as having a piece of chocolate. There's a desire to want that. And then when it's fulfilled, there is a release of that tension between having and not having. And how that's just kind of a normal tendency of the mind. And how the sitting here is sitting with that normal tendency of the arising of the mind to have something be different than it is, or to have something that we don't have. And in this sitting practice, to just sit with that quietly and watch that arise and fall, and to not move and be there with it, and then finally to reach a point where there might be gaps between the thoughts or gaps between the arising of desires, and to just sit here and experience those gaps. The big trick is to take that into the real world where we're inundated with things. Here we're not having, like I said, interruptions. There's not people knocking at the door saying, can you answer the phone? Phone's ringing. There's not phones in here. There's not computers, dogs. Nothing's happening in here. There's this great respect for the stillness that we have. So how do we take that into the real world? At practice. And as the things out there arise, I've noticed that now there's not such a tendency to put such a deep hook into things as there were before. There's more of a tendency to have something arise but not taking any action on it. So, the Buddha was saying that we should generate desire for the sake of fostering skillful qualities and abandoning unskillful ones. And just speaking of myself again, the arising of just the acknowledgement of habits that I'd had in the past and new habits that seem to be arising. And that brings me to what I just did recently when I took these when I took these vows, when I took these precepts, And it was just a little while ago. And what, just kind of what I've been noticing from taking these. And one of these is, it says here, no stealing. And that's something that's been arising often. And even in the most subtle ways, I love flowers, and I love to look at them, and I like to put them on my altar. You know, I bring them in, and I give an offering, and I put flowers. And I was looking at these beautiful flowers yesterday, and I thought to myself, am I stealing those flowers? Is that something that is being given freely? And if so, how do I ascertain if that has been given freely? Just little subtle things like that were really interesting. And taking the dry eraser from work the other day, seeing it on my desk at home and going, well, I don't remember Steve Jobs saying, please, Robert, have this dry eraser, take it home. And that being my prop here, I don't know if this was freely given.
It was.
Oh, well, thank you. But that's what I mean. And it's very interesting to say these out loud and noticing the very subtle shift in my practice and how I'm looking at these things now daily. One very interesting one is no killing life. Now, I consider myself to be quite the proponent of not eating meat and animals and things like that. But Mr. Carrot, I got to kill that, right, to live. That has to be killed. So that's another thing I'm kind of pondering on. All the things that are really being killed, or I am killing, to be able to survive. So that brings me to this part about failure within this practice. And how I think failure is an option. And taking these precepts and really knowing that I can't keep them. I don't really think I can keep them. I can work at it. But no being angry, that's really difficult. My dog the other day stepped on my foot and it hurt terribly, and I yelled at him, and then that precept popped into my mind. So what's that about? Why are these things now suddenly popping into my mind? I don't remember really making any kind of real sordid effort to make them arise when things were happening. It's very interesting. They're just kind of creeping in. Filling in these spaces and these moments around when these things come up. So, once again, in failure, I don't meditate every day. Oh, that's a big failure. I should be diligently meditating first thing in the morning and first thing in the evening. But because of my life and how busy it is, I fail at that. And I fail at that often. I also fail on some of these other things too. And this is a big one. This is my big confessional. I noticed this very interesting in relationships that I have with people, that there has been a bond in some cases created around these relationships of talking about other people and their shortcomings, or making myself look better than someone, especially at work. And I find this one to be something that has just really jumped into the forefront after taking the precepts. And I think that this is really a wonderful teaching. And it's interesting to see how, like I said before, sometimes the foundation in some relationships is around this, built around complaining or talking about other people. And in just noticing being with some friends that there is a leaning towards talking about other people. And I find that a challenging one, a very interesting precept to take. And no praise or blame. And I had an example happen the other day that I thought was very interesting. On our property, we have a bunch of horses. It's not our property. We live there. And there's a young lady there that has a horse. And she started talking about her dad, and I know her dad. And she started talking pretty negatively about her dad. And I noticed a pattern of wanting to also talk in negative ways. And in that moment of, there was this brief moment of being aware of that, and I suddenly didn't let that come out. And I just listened to her, and I didn't try to correct what she was saying, but I was just noticing my wanting to start to talk behind his back. And in noticing that, trailing back over the years and looking at all the relationships that were built around this. I don't know if any of you have experienced that, but there are many relationships built around complaining or talking shit is how we say it about someone behind their back. And noticing how that kind of correlated with me in my life, or was this model of being accepted or being cool, you know, building the relationship based upon complaining about George. And noticing that being a real failure. And just coming back to that and just saying that failure is an option. I don't mean failure so much as failure like I have done something bad, or I have tried and not succeeded in my goal. And that brings me back to another very interesting point about the practice. When we sit without a goal. We sit with no attainment. You know, once we really realize that there's nothing to attain, then we can rely on the prajna paramita. And in that moment when this woman was complaining about her horse, that arose. And I thought, what is the prajna paramita? And in that moment, the prajna paramita was silence. not saying a word to what she was saying. And in sitting here like this, when we sit without any kind of gaining idea, and we sit without any looking at and facing our desires as they come and not acting on them because we're sitting still, that really does come into real life. That really does come into how things play out. I don't know if it's something that I'm experiencing because I'm relatively new at this, but I do notice that is encroaching upon my daily life, that what happens here in this room, on this thing, seems to bleed over into what's happening in my daily life. And which brings me to again, no praise, and just looking at not being proud of that. Like, wow, I'm really something. I'm Mr. Zen. I didn't say anything, and I kept my mouth shut, and wow, I'm really doing a good job with this. And we run back and tell Tanya, and run back and tell my wife, hey, I didn't, you know, get into this conversation with her, this negative conversation. And just noticing that, wanting to have the praise for doing a good job with my Zen practice. So I think that that kind of brings me back to the desire and that this wonderful statement, because I got caught for a while in thinking that I didn't want to turn my desire to not have desire into a desire. I got caught up in that in this practice for a while, thinking that now I'm going to desire not to desire. And that could be a bumpy road. Until I read these words about what the Buddha said about that. And I just wanted to repeat that we should use skillfully applied desire. And I think that does emanate from this time that we spent together and how we take this out into the world. And how success fits into that is the wanting or needing a recognition that somehow we've reached some sort of state or level. And being able to just work on not being attached to any particular outcome of any of this is another thing that I'm working on, that kind of is attributed to success. It's hard to do this and not have some kind of level that we can say, well, I've reached level 11 in Zazen and I just got my new junior Buddha button and I'm doing a great job. That's kind of tough. But I find that it circles back. It circles back to how we do this with the non-attainment. Because with that non-attainment and non-attachment and the whole concept that I see as the Heart Sutra, that there's a liberation there and a deep freedom to simply just be in the moment without too much judgment on ourselves and others, and to not be so hard on ourselves in the practice, and to just let it become ordinary, as someone once told me. Thank you for that one. And not making such a big deal out of it. So that's about all I got to say about that in the words of Forrest Gump. Anybody have anything they would like to add to that or speak of?
In the context of that precept of no praise and no blame, I've noticed that too, that there's a certain level that you want to meet someone at. And the desire is actually to meet another, to actually connect. But you're afraid maybe, or unclear that you can meet them like a Buddha meeting a Buddha, or like someone very successful meeting someone else very successful. Instead, in order to meet someone, sometimes there's this tendency to go way down. And actually, rather than disparaging others, complaining about others, I think what people do also is they complain about themselves,
yeah,
or their lives or circumstances of their lives. So they come to meet another person on that sort of, it's kind of safer, or you, maybe your odds are better or something, to meet someone like, say, oh, I really had a bad day. Did you have? And then the other person can say, I had a bad day too. And then you can complain about your bad day, your life. But the background is actually you've met another. You've connected with another person. I think that's kind of mixed up in that. As far as the intention is, you actually want to meet another person, you want to connect. So it's almost like the safest way to do it is the lowest way. So even at work, when you and your friends are complaining about another, you're kind of going down there to meet, you know, because you and your friends would have in common that you'd assume you'd have in common that you're both unhappy about the situation, or you don't like that person.
Yeah, that common ground.
Yeah, that common ground. That's the way to put it. Yeah. But it's very hard to assume that you'd have a common ground in saying, I really value this person. He's really an excellent person. There's nothing wrong with him. He's exemplary. He's perfect. It'd be very hard to meet another to actually connect with another on that higher level. So it's kind of like our psychology is, or our desire to actually meet another, to connect, is sort of wrapped up in that no praise, no blame thing. Yeah. I've noticed that phenomenon. It's very interesting.
And I think it connects too with that making yourself look better than others in some cases. Because when someone talks positive about someone else, you're going to want to, no, that person isn't that great of a designer. I did that back in 95, you know. You want to, you know, boost yourself up a little bit in some cases. Just noticing that with myself.
In terms of where to meet, oftentimes I do go, I don't know, up there in with the people I work with. I say, hey, man, I really like working with your crew. You guys are really professional. I really appreciate being with you guys. And
what does that do?
I'm hit with silence.
What do you want? It makes me very suspicious.
This guy's pitching something.
It's funny.
I'll try the underground route.
It's interesting the way Coleman put it. You know, it's written, the other translations of the precepts are written quite a bit different than Coleman's. It's like no praise and no blame. So you don't, when you meet a situation, you don't, or another, or anything, you don't make it bigger than it is. You don't puff it up. Dramatize.
Yeah, that's Robert Jackson.
Yeah,
the drama queen.
Yeah, or you don't deflate it or disparage it. You just meet it. The precept is kind of saying, just meet things as they are, as you are, as it is. It's very interesting how he.
That's very
no praise, no blame.
No praise,
very,
no blame.
Very simple, but it's got a lot of stuff in it. Different with a child, though, huh, Elizabeth? Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just thinking, when you raise a young child, you have to...
You have to what?
You have to kind of train and build. Maybe not. Maybe it's the same thing.
Maybe it's just chickens. Mike, can I comment on that? With kids, it's important not to flatter them, but to say, look what, here's what you did, here's what you accomplished, and to be very accurate about it so they can see what they've done and to notice what they've done. But any time you say, oh, you're the smartest kid, you're the most wonderful, beautiful kid in the world, either they know that's bullshit, or if they don't, that's not very good for them either.
In the meeting, like that.
But for them to know that you notice what they're doing and what they're accomplishing and what they're working on and what they're trying to do. That's a good thing. So it's just as you were saying before with adults, really. Mm.
Category of commiseration. I do think that it's important when someone shares with you a wound they've experienced to help them feel understood. And sometimes that's all it takes.
Yeah, that's what I was doing with her. Yeah. I was kind of having in that moment empathy. I'm like, yeah, dads are tough. Sometimes they don't understand where you're coming from.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's pretty rare for people to feel understood.
Or even heard.
Mm. Yeah.
Does anybody know about this category of workers in Britain? A lot of Holly's, my wife, is reading this book about this woman, and she talks about being in prison, and then she became a listener. And they have these people that are like go around and just listen.
I've heard about that before.
Sounds like something we should investigate.
In prison?
And in just as a public official, you're a listener. But a lot of them came from prison. It's a job they can do.
Don't they have that in Canada too? I think that's where I heard about it.
And then we were talking here last week about going
his sign
to a park
his sign
and saying,
"I'm
here
to listen." Yeah.
And there's a poster with a cat on it that says, "What 80% of people need is just a good listen." Also make people very nervous by just listening.
I've noticed that.
If you want to use it as a tool.
They get nervous and they get uncomfortable and they keep talking because they're nervous and they keep saying more and more.
When I was working for the paper, I used to just do investigative stories and I found you ask a question or two and then you let people talk. Mm-hmm. And most people will talk.
I was just doing some interviews for my podcast, and that's what I was doing. I was asking people four different questions, and I noticed that when you just ask them the question and you don't say a word, the results are really good, like where you're not getting ready to say the next thing. You're just sitting there listening, and it's pretty cool. Some neat results with that.
Nature abhors a vacuum.
So if there's no praise or blame, I guess, how do you meet people?
It's a new way. It's all new.
Just bow.
It could be praise. It could be blame.
Depends on how you do
the
it.
The blaming bow.
The blaming bow. I could have done a rude gesture, but I held back.
Dogs are good. And then your dogs go through the procedure of like... sniffing.
The dog procedure.
And you can always say, "What a wonderful, beautiful dog you have." Today we were walking our dog, and we met this other dog, and the other dog ran out and just bowed down, rolled over, peed on the ground, and just like total subservience. And
are you suggesting we try that?
No.
I've already got a reputation. I don't want to tarnish it. We could try it, Doug.
It must have been a smaller dog. Huh?
Little dog.
It's your dog's pretty big.
Yeah, our dog's pretty big, but this dog was
whoa, angels in a certain way. You know, I mean, every once in a while, yeah, there's those situations too. But for the most part, it's not all angels singing. It's, wow, I could have handled that better.
Mm.
You know, and just try to continually apply that understanding and how that grows and evolves and changes, you know, but having the courage to try again. You know, it'd be easy to just say, oh, wow, I really screwed that one up.
Yeah.
I'm never going to do that again. And in the never doing it again, you're missing out opportunities to have that angel moment. So I appreciate that part of your talk, I think.
It's funny, that brings me right back to praise and blame. Isn't that funny? How that it goes right back to that. How you want to praise yourself for doing a good job, or how you want to blame yourself for not doing a good job in that point. They all just circle back to each other. The more I'm looking at them, the more I see how they all just kind of intertwine and circle back. You know, and it's interesting too, I think we have this human condition that we focus on those so-called failures that are really, like in quotes, failures. And we very rarely, when something good happens, do we expound upon it. It's really funny, you know, we kind of let these, there's like a million good things that happened already, and there's not really any connection to them sometimes.
Yeah. I think part of it, though, too, is when you do the good thing.
Yeah.
Instead of, when we do a bad thing, sometimes, like, I see this in yoga a lot, where people will, like, they'll actually, like, stomp, and they'll take, like, this big breath, and, it takes them a while to get back into it, but we can do the same thing when we do something really good. You know, you might have it, and you go, hey. You know, and I think maybe with continued practice, it's either of those things. The gap is, you know, instead of when you fail, instead of you just there isn't the stop. You know, maybe you just go right into it. And the same thing with when you do something really well. It's you don't need to stop yourself and say, "Hey, I did that pretty well."
Mm.
You know, it's not even a thought. You know, you're just in the next moment, in the potential to fail or not.
Nice. I like that.